Okay, so this is our last session together. Our time has gone very fast, I feel. And it will be an opportunity to not only reflect on what I've just been talking about, solitude and inner autonomy, but perhaps also to draw some thoughts about the whole experience we've had since Friday, since the symposium. So let's just see how we can most fruitfully spend this time. And one or two people have to leave a bit early, so they'll be slipping out. Otherwise, we'll end this at 1 o'clock when lunch is served. Who would like to? Ah, two hands went up at the same time. Let's start with Wolf, and then here, and then there. Yeah. Well, the best there is an essay called "On Solitude," and I think it's book two. Essay, I can't remember. It's easy to find. It's one of the most famous essays, actually. You'll get a lot of the information there, but Montaigne being Montaigne, in other words, chaotic, these essays are very weirdly structured. And he's aware of this. He says, "My mind roams here and there without much of a plan." So what I had to do was read all of the essays over the last couple of years and then track down precisely the passages where he talks about these things. And what I could do, actually, I could email you some of my own selections, and that'll give you all that stuff. Oh, Winnicott, yeah. Mm-hmm. I see. So introject, you means internalize the mother's ability to be solitary. No? Oh, so they need to be held in a sympathetic and supportive space. Oh, that's interesting. So the implication would be that a child who grows up without that kind of emotional holding never has difficulty to be content or able to. Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, that would also then, if Thomas is right with this geistige autonomie, then it would be more than just an internal mindfulness or rationality. It also requires a social environment as a child to give you the security to feel. Oh, that's very interesting. So some psychotherapies would actually then be ways of to aim to develop the child's or the adult's sense of their own autonomy. Interesting. Thank you. Lost in space. So without any boundaries at all. awful sense of would that mirror somehow the distinction between einsam sein und Einsamkeit, aloneness and loneliness? Alleinsam, alleinsein, being alone. Einsamkeit means loneliness. It's in French, it's even more tricky. La solitude in French means both. You see. It's tricky. You had a question? And then we'll... I think the bad reputation, I think you're right, but I think Buddhism often feels it defensive. It's constantly accused of, you know, just navel-gazing, cutting yourself off from the world, and Buddhist teachers are often at great pains to point out that this is a practice that's very much about connectedness, very much about concern for others. But I think it would be a shame that the value of solitude thereby somehow gets lost in order to somehow present Buddhism as more about engaging with the world, which I think is totally important. But you see, to me, and this goes back to my training as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, basically studying Buddhist theory, Mahayana Buddhist theory. And there you have a very useful definition of enlightenment, or the Buddha, of buddhite, of awakening, which the awakened person, it says, is someone who has achieved their own meaning, literally, and simultaneously has achieved meaning for others. In other words, they have somehow managed to integrate their inner life with their social life. It's the integration of these two dimensions of our being that constitutes the goal of the practice, not one or the other. And Buddhism has struggled with this. I think most traditions have always struggled a bit with, you know, which is more important, or how does one not contradict the other, all these kind of things. But one of the reasons I've gone back to this topic is because I think it is so central. And I think a Dharma practice is one that needs to give equal value to both sides, and not to be tempted to privilege social involvement over a cultivation of our own inner autonomy. And I think what Thomas said was very illuminating about that. And to not listen to these, I think, often superficial criticisms of meditation, which say, oh, it's all about just yourself and all this stuff. I think this is very silly, frankly. It's not really understanding the bigger picture. So I can understand why in some traditions you might get this dismissal or this failure even to acknowledge the value of solitude. It's like Agnes Martin. She said solitude is considered to be a dangerous condition. And I feel we kind of have to fight against that and restore it. There's a wonderful quotation by Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, where I don't have the text to hand, but he says something like, he says, it's very easy to live according to your own values in solitude, on a mountain, say. And it's very easy to go along with the opinion of the world in society. But for him, the goal of his philosophical life is to be able to maintain what he calls the sweetness of my solitude in the midst of the crowd, in the midst of the world. That's his expression of that. That it's about integrating these two dimensions of one's life, and to the point where, in fact, to be really engaged with the world in an effective way requires that one is rooted and grounded in one's own inner autonomy, which gives one a very clear commitment to your deepest values, what really counts for you. And to be able somehow to be able to take a stand. That's crucial if we are to be effective in the world, I would suggest. Again, in my book, I left my iPad upstairs, I could have read you these quotes, but there's a beautiful quotation from Nelson Mandela about solitude. He had solitude imposed upon him. 27 years. And after he was released, he talks about how valuable the silence of solitude was in order to understand the power of language. It's interesting. For him, it's the solitude that actually made him aware of how precious words are in communicating to people what it means to live in society, for example. This is this paradox of solitude, which comes up again and again and again. And that, I think, is at the core of this practice, too, very much. The gentleman with the beard, and then here. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry? Oh, Song Guangsa? Oh, that's where I live, yeah. Oh. You've been there? Oh. Yeah. The stepping stones. Oh, coward. The future of all illusions. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the four. Oh, the four consolations, yes, that you get in the Kalama Sutta, yes. This is Freud, right? That heaven. I see. Oh, I see. The heaven, of course, Himmel also means the sky, right? What is this? Gosh. Well, you have to let all of those thoughts go now and come back to and come back to the question and start again. Yes. Oh, good. On the four stars. Yeah. Stopping of the reactors. That's correct. No, this is a good question, and one that is often asked. And I also used to think that it was a little bit unclear, this. It seemed to be sort of not really necessary. Someone said, well, what's the difference between letting go of reactivity and seeing the stopping of it? It seems to be kind of just talking of the same thing, really. But more and more, I've come to change my mind and to feel that this third step is actually die Wendepunkt des Pfades, the turning point of the path. I think it's very, very central. I think it's absolutely central. And what I think it, I can, in my own experience, what I think it means really is to valorize, you know, valorize, to give value to the experience of being still and open and non-reactive. It is to consciously affirm that experience, even if it's only brief, but to begin to affirm it not just intellectually by labeling it, let's say, but actually to get more and more the feeling, the sensation of this stopping, this stilling, right through your whole body-mind. It's not just going on in your mind, your head. Well, no, this, you see, the stopping of reactivity doesn't mean the stopping of reactivity. The stopping of reactivity means you can be in the midst of reactivity. The reactivity could be going off, firing on all cylinders. But you, as long as you are mindful and attentive, the mindfulness is not reactive. The stopping of reactivity is already present when you simply pay attention in an open, calm, and clear way. So you can be mindfully aware of your reactions, but the mindful awareness is not reactive. So the point, therefore, is to begin, is to consciously notice what it feels like in your body to be mindful. That, I think, is very important. And in your emotions, not to think of mindfulness as just a kind of detached observer. That is often how it sort of comes across. It's not like that. Mindfulness over time becomes something more and more that suffuses, durchdringen, your whole experience. And I mean, I'm very, very aware of this. I notice this a lot now. And I think it's very central to somehow understand our meditative stance or posture as something that is really a way of being in the world in its totality, not just a spiritual state. It's a modality of living, this stance, this posture. The trouble is that as we cultivate these qualities, in some ways they become so familiar that we don't really pay attention to them anymore. It just becomes sort of second nature. And that's important too. But I do feel that in formal meditation, it is helpful every now and again to actually stop and look and taste and sense this non-reactive stance. Because that's, in a sense, where this, in Thomas's language, this geistige Autonomie is actually grounded in this sense of this foundational capacity to be aware, to be conscious. And that's what you train and develop in the practice. Michael and then Katarina. Yeah. Yeah, that is perfectly, to be honest, I prefer the word behold too. In English, behold, though, it's got a slightly biblical feel to it. It's not a word used in everyday language. Behold, the bus is coming. You might say, behold the angels on high in heaven, but not behold the bus that's coming down the road. So it's a behold, that's another problem. It means to see something in a... Behold the glory of the Lord. See, behold, see it for yourself. And that is very close, actually, to Satchikaroti in Pali. Which Satchi means eyes. It's an old Pali word for the eyes. And karoti is in the root kar, to do. So it's to eyeball in English slang. Eyeball. But, of course, you don't want to say that either. But one of the reasons I don't use behold, I use see, is in order to preserve my acronym, ELSA, you see. Otherwise, it would be ELBA, and that makes me think of Napoleon. Katarina. Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. No, that was very interesting. No, very, very clearly stated. No, I agree with all of that. I think being autonomous in one's ethical life is actually very challenging. It's not easy. It's so much easier, as Emerson says, just to go along with the way the world thinks, to what our friends think, to what our Buddhists, what the Buddhists do. It's much easy to go along with the crowd. But I don't think that's at all what the Buddha was interested in. I think he was genuinely seeking to provide a framework in which people could learn to establish a deep ethical integrity within their own, within their own lives. And to me, therefore, this practice of meditation is cannot be separated from the cultivation of an ethical perspective on life. They're not two separate things at all. They actually are inseparable, frankly. So yeah, thank you. That's good. Yes. Okay. Well, actually, to be honest, I think the doctrine of karma... let's start again. When you find yourself in a Buddhist situation, you'll hear people say karma and rebirth as though it's basically one thing. The two are so connected in the Buddhist mind that you often wonder if they're really different at all. But obviously they are different. They're completely different. They're logically entirely different things. Rebirth effectively serves as a vehicle to explain how your actions will affect you after you're dead. That's the main reason that rebirth is necessary, is to provide a vehicle for the continuity of your acts. But actually, if you let go of the idea of rebirth, which I do, I either understand rebirth as just the cycles of reactivity. In other words, it's a way of symbolically talking about that. But the idea that, you will, after death, you'll get reborn in this form or another, I'm completely agnostic about that. I don't think we have any evidence at all that this happens, or very little. And I don't think it's actually pertinent to how we live now, really, to be honest. But karma, I think, is another thing altogether. And by removing rebirth, you've already secularized it, because you then understand action, let's say action rather than karma. Action is effectively something that we need to pay attention to. In fact, I did secularize it earlier this morning. I said, we need to be mindful not only of our values and of our experience, but also mindful of what our intentions and our actions, and to be mindful of the consequences on others and on ourselves of our actions. That is a secularization of it. But I think another important point is not to make it entirely, that makes it, again, look very individualistic. It's also important to recognize that by taking out rebirth, you do not take out a sense of responsibility for what will happen after your death. So, in other words, although I might die tomorrow, my actions will continue to have consequences. They will have consequences on anybody who reads one of my books and decides, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting, let's go do that. Or, on the contrary, no, this is heretical rubbish, let's destroy all of these books. The point is that I'm not around anymore. I'm dead, but my work, my actions are continuing to play out long after I'm gone. If you take someone like Shakespeare or Goethe, you know, they're dead, but their words and their inspiration and their insights are still living on with us. And in many ways, I feel that that's, again, it's very, I think, valuable to acknowledge that our actions that we commit now will have consequences long after we're gone. Take, for example, the usage of fossil fuels. If we take airplanes and drive cars and use up this finite resource of oil, we're actually contributing to a future that others, our descendants and others, will have to then deal with. So to have a responsibility for what happens after one's death is very important from a purely secular point of view. The only difference is that I don't need to be around to witness it. And to me, what matters is not whether I experience the results of my actions, but whether my actions will produce effects in others who I don't know. I have no sense of who they might be, but nonetheless, they are living beings like myself. And what I'm doing now, what all of us are doing now, will have a consequence on their lives. So I think for an environmental or an ecological awareness, we need to take very much into account the consequences of our actions after our death. But we don't need rebirth at all. It's unnecessary. There's other problems as well, but that alone, I think, is enough to point that out. So we must be careful not to reject rebirth and karma in one sweep, but instead to let go of the notion of rebirth, perhaps, if we wish, but to also rethink what we mean by our understanding of how our actions have consequences, both in the short term and in the long term. Of what position? Oneness. Uh-huh. I know. No, that's okay. I think I understand. I mean, you can certainly. I've heard many Buddhist teachers say that if you don't believe in rebirth, then just recognize that in your life now, every day, every moment, you're being reborn. Is that what you mean? No, I don't understand this oneness thing. Okay, well, that's not strictly speaking a Buddhist idea. That you'll certainly find that in... Well, then you must take that issue up with your Zen teacher. But this is... that's actually much closer to Vedanta. Big mind. Yeah, all of this stuff, it's all Vedanta. The Buddha never spoke like this, ever. Well, Buddhist teachers say all kinds of weird things. I'm a Buddhist. A Buddhist teacher is not the last. I'm not. Don't believe what I say. Check it out for yourself. I don't take it on my authority. But Frank, that you do find this in forms of Japanese Zen. And this idea of big mind and so on, which is very popular, what Genpo developed, is really not, strictly speaking, a Buddhist idea. Well, that's what I was talking about with Shantideva. Like, the whole world is a single organism. Remember what I was just saying? Yeah, but this is not what's meant by reincarnation. No, reincarnation has to do with repetition, of going round in circles. There's an awful lot in what you say that I need to unpack. The reincarnation for Buddhists is the problem. Reincarnation is that which keeps us stuck in circles, going round and round and round and not getting anywhere. You can understand that on a cosmic level. You know, you physically die, you get reborn, you live another life, you die, you get reborn, and this just goes on forever. It's called samsara, the cycle of birth and death. Well, every Buddhist tradition has got a different theory about this, you see. I mean, some will say that it's totally unclear. And when you go to the early Buddhist texts, you find... The Buddha says very clearly that the consciousness is not reborn. Consciousness, he says, it emerges out of the interactions between the organism and the environment. Consciousness is an emergent property. If you take away the body and the mind, and consciousness disappears. So the Buddha doesn't provide us with any notions like a big mind or a consciousness that can survive death. That's completely absent in early Buddhism. Later Buddhism, including Theravada Buddhism, develops a theory of reincarnation, and it explains it in a different way. So the Theravadins will say what gets reborn is what's called the Bhavanga Chitta, the rebirth consciousness, as it were. The Tibetans will say what gets reborn is the subtle union of energy and mind on which the notion of I has been imputed. Highly abstract philosophical idea. Other Buddhist traditions will say it's mental consciousness that gets reborn. But what this shows, the fact that Buddhists do not agree on any of these things, is that this is probably just speculation. And frankly, I think the problem with this rebirth stuff is that it's completely irrelevant to how I live now. Completely irrelevant. And an idea like big mind, for example, can be practically useful, I agree. But I think it's a very problematic metaphysical theory that effectively is what the Buddha would have called sasatavada. It's the belief in something permanent, a consciousness, a big mind that is looking out through all of our bodies that never... That is basically something that never changes. It's the mind of God, basically. Yeah, but that's also a big mistake. Clearly. Okay. No, we can't. And even if we do lots of terrible things and we die, the terrible things will continue, and we'll. Well, I'm not quite sure what we are, to be honest. That's what... Where should we go? I think that's a question you need to sit with. That's your what is this? Where shall we go? Thank you. Yes. that's lovely. Infinite space starts at your own cheek. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's lovely, yeah. It's nice. Wonderful. Well, if Rilke didn't say it, he should have done. Okay, anything else? Or can we maybe wrap now, as they say in the film business? Yes. Yes. I think this is very true. And you see, in a sense, we're born alone and we die alone. Aloneness is, in a way, an existential condition. And I think we spend a lot of our lives running away from that condition. And the practice of meditation or the practice of philosophy is about accepting our condition, accepting the great matter of birth and death, as the Chinese say, and being fully open to the mystery of our birth and the mystery of our death. But to do that, I do feel, requires that we touch the same depth of existential aloneness in each moment. And I think meditation is a practice that can enable us more and more to be more deeply in touch with our own existential aloneness, which paradoxically enables our ability to recognize that everyone we meet, everyone in the world, those people who are closest to us, who we love, are also existentially alone. The two go together very much. But yeah, that's basically it. And to me, the great test of my Buddhist practice will be my death. How do I really face that? It's all very well to sort of say these sort of high-minded things on workshops like this, but when I actually come to be diagnosed with a terminal illness and my life is literally fading away, how will I be there? And if I'm really honest, I have to say I don't know. I really don't know. But that will be the test, really. Okay, a bit of self-promotion. There's a book here that's just been published by Gaia House, the retreat center I work at in England. It's called What Is This? Reflections from a Son or Zen Retreat. This is a transcription of talks and instructions I gave on What Is This? At a retreat in England a couple of years ago. And this is a privately published booklet that is effectively a fundraising exercise. There's a limited number of these available from Gaia House if you're interested, but what we're now working on is an expanded edition of this book that will be published by a small publishing house in New Zealand, which will also be called What Is This? But it will be by Stephen and Martine Batchelor. So Martine has, all of the talks and instructions Martine gave have now just been transcribed, and Martine is working on editing them. And the next edition of the book, which will be commercially available, will be twice as long, and it will include everything that Martine and I said on this retreat. I'll leave this here if you want to have a look at it. And that brings me to this book, which has also just been published by the rather strange-sounding tuwiri, which is a Maori word. I don't know what it means. This has just been published. It's a workbook to my book, After Buddhism, which some of you might have read, Jenseits des Buddhismus, fat book. And this is something that was put together by a colleague of mine in Australia. He gave about a 15-week course on studying After Buddhism, and then develop that into this workbook. So if you're interested in After Buddhism, Jenseits des Buddhismus, the book, then this is something you can use to help in your own understanding and study of the text. It's got lots of exercises, questions, discussion topics, and stuff like that. So I'm going to leave both of these books here in the care of Jochen. They're for you. And the fact, the company that's going to reissue this is these people. This is a newly founded publishing venture in New Zealand, which is focused on developing a list of books on secular Buddhism. It's called After Buddhism, a Workbook. After Buddhism, a Workbook. I'll bring along a copy of this, Wolf, to our next meeting in Holland. So I'll leave these here if anyone wants to look at them. Please don't take them away. They're not for sale. And Jochen, please accept them as a gift when things are over. Well, like in most places on the internet, you'll be able to order this. I think this one you can actually now get from Amazon. This one you can't. But when this is reissued, it'll be available on Amazon and these other media. You can order it through a bookstore if you want. Yes. Oh, the online course. Yeah, thank you for reminding me about that. There is currently online a six-week program on mindfulness, its origins, something, and its purpose. It's origin, practice, and purpose or something, which is a six-week distance learning program with Christina Feldman, John Peacock, Akinchino Weber, and myself. And it offers 6-hour-long modules that present the wider context of mindfulness, both from a psychological perspective, a philosophical perspective, an ethical perspective. It includes individual presentations from the four different teachers, and a lot of filmed discussion between the four of us. It's currently available. You can join this course. You can do that through Tricycle Magazine, www.tricycle.com. Oh, that's good. Great. Okay. And it's got a couple more weeks to run, but if you can still join the course, and you'll then have access to all of the modules. In fact, you'll have access to the modules for as long as you live, once you've paid your $160 or whatever it is. And wie viel? Oh, there you go. So you can get a bargain through the Buddha Stiftung. Oh, good. I wasn't aware of that. I think some people here are doing that course. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so if you want the real goods, ask these people if it's any good or not. I'm obviously have a vested interest, so don't trust me. But I think it might be an interesting way to engage with some of these bigger issues around the use of mindfulness and its practice. Okay, let's stop. thank you very much for being here. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Jochen and Regina, for making it all possible. Thank you, the University of Heidelberg, for allowing us to use these incredible premises. And thank you for you being here, which has made it all possible too. Thank you.